Everybody, welcome to the Jeff Rubin, Jeff Rubin Show. I am Jeff Rubin. Joining me on the Skype and phone today is Sean Fitzpatrick. Sean, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jeff.
Sean, how would you describe your art career, your professional art career?
Let's see. Wow. I probably have to say that I've been successful making art that doesn't last. Basically, I focus on creating sculptures using materials like sand, ice, pumpkins. I do 3D chalk and street art, street painting. So none of those are really specifically geared to be permanent works of art, but they're really meant for kind of human interaction and like first-person entertainment.
And is that intentional on your part? Were you like, I want to create pieces of art that don't last? Or you just happened to find you were good at chalk, which led to this other thing?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story because I really had never done any sculpting at all until my daughter was about 3 years old. And she had asked me to go outside and build her a snowman. And I was like, yeah, sure. And I had always had the gift where I could draw. Like if I could see something, I could put it to paper, you know, pen, paint, whatever. You know, I could see it, I could make it. But I had never really done a lot of sculpting. I honestly wasn't the biggest kid in class. And so when the teacher was handing out the clay, most of the big kids got the clay and, you know, they kind of chucked it around the room and I really didn't end up with much. So like I said, it was kind of one of those things where I think it was just bound to happen at one point. But once I got into it, I immediately fell in love with the fact that I could create artwork relatively quickly on a pretty large scale. And as the time moves on with like especially snow and ice and even sand sculptures, the sculptures kind of take on a life of their own and they do change over time. You know, whether it's the snow or ice melting or the sand kind of deteriorating, shows signs of wear. And for me, it was always about like speaking about time, like how important time is.
What were you doing before you built that fateful snowman that day? What were you doing before that?
So I spent about 22 years in the automotive field. I was a mechanic for Ford Lincoln Mercury, and I was like a top-rated technician for the New England area. They used to send me a lot of NTSB cars, crash cars, things that a lot of the average technicians didn't have time to spend on to try to figure out problem cars, things like that. And I was successful at it, but I was kind of stifled because I was always drawing. And then when I had started getting into this sculpting as a hobby, it kind of got out of control and I realized I had potential to do something with that.
Now's probably a good time to direct people to your social media so they can see the kind of sculptures that we're talking about here. Where can people go to see some of your work?
So I'm Fitzy Snowman on Instagram, and it's the same thing pretty much on Facebook. It's Fitzy Snowman Sculpting. The website is fitzysnowman.com, so I'm pretty easy to find. I also have a couple other sites that deal with 3D chalk, specifically 3dchalk.com. And I also do some community events, and I do the World Championships or the World's Best Sand Sculpting Championship every few years. I haven't done it since 2015.
So I'm going to put all those links in the podcast description so people can click through to kind of see the work we're talking about here. How long was that transitional period? Like how long between that first snowman and I am no longer a mechanic? This is what I do now.
Yeah, I think it took some time for sure. I mean, we're talking back to like 1992, 1993, and I did not really start to seriously see the value of how I would apply this hobby as a business until like around 2000. And I had found that there was a sand sculpting competition up in New Hampshire, and I had visited that, and I met with probably a dozen artists that they had traveled pretty much all over the country from, I believe it was April to September, just carving sand at these little competitions. And these guys were pretty top in their ranks. Like that's all they did, like, for fun, you know, like, they would use their vacation time and things like that, and most of them were artists or had some type of art background, but they, most of them had other jobs. I just found it fascinating, and for me, I was, like, looking at what the business aspect of it for me was, because I knew it wasn't going to be going from competition to competition, just because I didn't see, like, a real long-term plan of that. You know, I thought it might end up getting me divorced in the long run, so I kind of decided that I would market myself more to, like, corporate needs and commercial art needs and kind of marketing, things like that. So I built my first website in 2000. It was fitzysnowman.com. And I think within a year or so, I had my first gig with Comcast, which is a big cable company and at the time, and now they're huge. And they had basically asked me to build a couple sandcastles at their events, and a couple turned into 16, and it was fun. It was a fun experience, you know, to be able to make money, a decent amount of money, doing what I really was passionate about for the first time. So I did see value at that, but I still continued to work at my job until 2006. And by 2006, I was using all my vacation time. Every weekend, I had jobs booked out. I was just about getting ready to start up a huge event in 2004 through 2005, and things kind of blew up. I was on the Today Show, Good Morning America, and I just walked into work one day and I said, I'm not going to do this anymore. You know, I'm going to try it out on my own and see what happens, and I've been doing it ever since.
All right, so I want to kind of talk about, like, I guess what's the other thing that's interesting about what you do is that they're, like, things that kind of everyone has tried. Like, I actually, like, everyone tries to build a snowman at some point, whereas not everyone actually tries to, like, sculpt something out of clay. And everyone's, like, tried to build a sandcastle. So I kind of know how hard it is, as opposed to working with clay, which I just assume is really difficult. So, like, I guess I'm curious, like, what are some tips you picked up along the way? Let's start with snow, and then we'll move into the more summer-appropriate sand. Like, what did you realize about working with snow that, like, not most people don't realize when they're just, like, trying to build a snowman with their kids?
Oh, yeah. So the first thing that really stood out to me was I always thought, I think just like everybody else, that, like, that snow that just falls that's super wet and it's sticky and it sticks together really well, I always thought that that was the best stuff to use. And in some instances, it can be, because it can be a very additive type of medium where you can kind of build things up versus taking them down, you know, like additive, more like clay than subtractive, which is like ice. But what I found over the years was that the drier the snow, the better the finished carving looks, as long as the snow is compacted, because you use the crystalline shape of the snow to lock it into shape by compacting it into some type of form. And I use wooden forms that are basically 2 feet tall, and I put them together so it's just the wall of the box. There's no top or bottom. And I can compact the snow into those and then literally just release the walls, and I'll have a cube of snow that I can carve. And it's all subtractive, but it's really soft and smooth, and I can get really nice cuts with it. And it's definitely more like a subtractive ice carving. But you, like I said, you can get some really great detail with it versus, you know, just making a ball of snow and trying to work with that. So that was, I think, the biggest surprise for me.
And how did you work that out? Was that like trial and error on your own? Did you read that in a book somewhere? Like, how long did it take you to come upon that process?
When I started traveling and doing projects in different states is when I really noticed it. Like, I was doing a project in Colorado, and we were on actually like a 3-city tour for the Dew Tour. So all the snowboarders and ski boarders and skiers were on this big tour, and we were tasked to make these trucks for Toyota, which was a big sponsor at the time. So going from different resort to different resort, I realized that the snow was very different from region to region. Like, Vermont snow was really hard and icy. You know, and I kind of give credit to people that ski a lot too, because I don't ski, but I do see the different qualities of snow. And so when I listen to snowboarders and stuff complain about different areas or or rave about different areas, I kind of have the same reaction. I was like, oh, that Colorado snow, it's great to ski in, but it's also great to carve with because it's so light and fluffy, and you can compact it, and it doesn't lose its crystalline shape. You're still getting those crystals. Once the snow melts, like out in Tahoe, for instance, it can be 30 minus overnight, but in the afternoon, it feels like it's 60 or 70 degrees with the sunlight. And you get people skiing around in their shorts, but the snow is super wet, and you lose those crystals. So then when you compact that wet snow, you end up with a block of ice versus like soft carvable snow. So you end up having to use chainsaws where maybe one city you were using chisels or like carving knives or like handsaws. You know, you have to break out the heavy guns when the snow's super wet because it literally makes a block of ice when you compact it.
And so like on this tour, for instance, it sounds like you're making a lot of trucks. You're going to different cities. Every city you get to the city, you got to make a snow truck, right?
Yeah.
And is it the same snow truck model? Like, do you have like what's like a mold of some kind, or you got to like essentially sculpt a new truck every time you sit down?
Yeah, it's literally a new truck. Like, I wish like sometimes that we had these big like blow cast molds that we could just kind of tip upside down. Unfortunately, I don't think that'd be too practical unless I had like a big helicopter or maybe a crane or something. But for the most part, we just start with a block of snow. So like I said, I'll take wooden forms and we'll compact that snow to get the shape that we want. And it's pretty strong and we can get pretty high with it as well because each form is only 2 feet tall, but we can stack them. So like I can stack as many forms as I can go high as long as my base is big enough to support the weight. And then you literally just take away everything that's not a truck because it's all subtractive. I'm not adding things on at all. I'm just starting literally like it was a block of stone, and I'm saying, okay, the tires are here, the grill is here, the windshield's here, and just make it from scratch every time. Yeah, so it was kind of crazy. Like some of them took like 4 or 5 days to make.
Is there like an eraser tool in snow? Can you just put more snow back, or does it work that way?
So you can patch small areas, but like you lose strength. You know, you lose that really tight bond that you had when you started with the original block. But yeah, you can repair certain areas. You have to use wet snow and you just add it in like you would be adding clay or to something like that, like a lump of clay, just a lump of wet snow, and kind of bond it with water and freeze it in place and then go back in and carve it again. But it really gets more like ice carving when you're doing repairs because you literally have to freeze stuff on in order for it to stay or in last any period of time.
And you were saying that it could take 4 or 5 days to make a sculpture?
Yeah, certainly, because these trucks were big. They were a little bigger than life-size trucks. So the one we did in Tahoe was probably double size. It was like 20 feet long and like 15 feet high, and so it was pretty crazy, yeah.
Do you need assistance at that point, or can you execute the whole thing yourself?
It's literally me and my wife, and we travel everywhere, and I remember when we were working at Tahoe, they decided that they were going to build the sculpture on the summit, which is, if you've been to, I'm sorry, not Tahoe, we were at Breckenridge, and they wanted to build it at the summit, and the summit's 12,000 feet. And there's not a lot of oxygen at 12,000 feet. So, and it's cold. Like, we were working at night, and I think the temperature was minus 36. And it was windy. And the thing was, it was like, I looked over at my wife, and we're from New England, and we're like, it really doesn't feel like it's minus 36. It feels cold out, but I'm not getting that cold New England snow or that cold New England air, or like, even like New York winters, you know how cold it gets in the on the East Coast here in the wintertime. I wasn't getting that, and like all the locals were dying, they were freezing. I was like, wow, this is great. So I just kept going, and it really wasn't that bad, other than it was so cold, like your teardrops in your eyes, like your eyelashes would freeze. That's the one thing I remember about it, just being that cold.
And that makes it more difficult, right?
I think it is, just because it's the conditions you're in. You've got no oxygen, so you get tired faster. And at the end of the day, you're at nighttime, you're walking down the summit from 12,000 feet. So you're walking a couple miles down the hill after you're done working. So we put in a lot of steps, I think, for that. And it's funny too, because people like show up while we're carving, and it seems like it could be a really glamorous job. And it, sometimes it is, but it's also a lot of work, like physical labor. Like I have to spend 2 hours a day in the gym just to be able to do what I do on a consistent basis. Otherwise, I'd have a heart attack. I would.
What kind of exercise do you need to do in the gym?
I do a lot of hand strengthening and body strengthening. So like today I was walking up and down stairs on my hands, and I did that for like an hour.
Wait,
straight.
Like on your hands, like on all fours, or just your
hands? No, like literally like doing a handstand, and then I set up like these benches and stairs, and I just do a handstand, and then I walk down the stairs.
Wow.
My hands, and I just rinse and repeat, and then I do handstands on like barbells, curl bars, so it's like super unstable, but it builds muscle strength, it builds tendon strength, so like my hands are super strong, and I need that for carving, because like I'm literally holding tools in one hand, just literally throwing my arm into whatever it is I'm carving. Like the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks, just building all those sand sculptures, having to move, you know, each day was 3 tons of sand, compacting it, carving it 9 hours a day, and then do the same thing the next day, the next day, the next day. So yeah, it was like, I think I lost like 6 pounds. Just working.
I have to commend your marriage skills, because here you are, considering a life of sandcastle competitions, which you know leads to divorce, and you're able to jujitsu that and actually come up with a way of doing that that brought your wife into it, where she is now doing this job with you. How did she become involved?
That is a great story. I had hired a woman to work with me in 2007, and we were going to replicate both a Lexus G35 and a magazine cover for the Best of Boston. So every year they come out with this list of all the businesses, and they publish the big magazine. It's a big deal to get in the magazine. Back in 2007, they were having this big beach party. So I hired this woman. About a day into the project, she's literally only 10% done with the magazine cover. And I looked over at my wife and I said, honey, you've got to go over there and you've got to give her some type of pep talk or see what you can do. Like, my wife had done no sculpting at all at that point. And she walked over to her and she whispered in her ear. And before I knew it, she had the girl that I hired laying out the design, and my wife was going right behind her and carving it. And they finished the whole thing in like less than 7 hours, and it came out perfect. Like, I couldn't tell you like how happy I was that A, now I knew I didn't have to hire anybody anymore. And B, like, my wife just crushed it, because the magazine editor, when he saw this girl working on it, just like was shaking his head and just didn't think it was going to be done. He told us as much. But when my wife jumped in, he like couldn't believe that they just banged it out. And to add insult to injury, had we failed, they literally had a full-size replica of the magazine blown up, printed right next to where the sculpture was being made. So yeah, they totally crushed it together, and I was like so happy. And so now, yes, yeah, she just like travels with me, and like we literally travel to some pretty cool places. We started working in Maui, and we love it out there. So now we go back there like twice a year just to relax, because we work so much. But yeah, it's not a bad thing. Like sometimes, like, she always reminds me that she sleeps next to me and that she does have an extra pillow. So, you know, I can be kind of an overbearing boss sometimes. She kind of keeps me in check and makes me realize that, hey, you still have to go home with me at the end of the day, so don't treat me like garbage.
Can anyone sculpt? Because what I'm hearing is you learned sculpting later in life, that you also had, you always had some sort of innate drawing talent. And here's your wife, and it's like the situation calls for it. And it's like, oh, wait a minute, she could be a professional sculptor too. Do most people, you think, have this talent and they just haven't really had a chance to exercise it?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it's open to debate, but my personal opinion is that yes, anyone, and it's kind of, you know, counterintuitive with most people think, and even kind of I thought. I always thought that I had this gift that I was just innately born with, but what I really think happens is that you find some type of release in life. And for me, it was art. And I just always did it. And I did it to obsession. And I did it so much that I got good at it. You know, I put in the 10,000 hours. I probably put in 100,000 hours. And I got good at it. And then when I did the sculpting, it was the same thing. The first sculpture I did was not pretty, let me tell you. It was just a snake. It was nothing fancy out of sand. Now, the snow sculpture was pretty cool, but when I first got into sand, it was just very basic. So, I mean, I look back at my work, and it gets better over the years just because I put more time into it. I think anyone can. I think the secret is, do you get tired of it? Does it fulfill a need for you? You know, when that stops being the case, I think you just don't focus on those things, you know? So, yeah, is it possible? Definitely. Like, but I'll tell you right now, my wife, it's not her passion. She will not do it as just for fun. If someone's paying her to do it, like, she's all about it. Like, she's right in there. But, like, for me, I'll go to the beach and I'll make something and just play around. And so it's, I think for us, it's different. But hers is more about necessity, and I can get this done and, you know, be a part of the relationship and contribute to it. And for me, it's just like, I can't even imagine doing anything else.
Okay, so that sets us up to talk about the sand sculpting, which is kind of what I the main thing I really wanted to talk about, because it's the summer. People are actually at the beach now. And I guess, like, I don't know, everyone's kind of had this experience where they try to make a sand castle, and I don't know, same kind of question we're talking about the snowman, like, what's the lowest hanging fruit that people are missing that they can use to kind of level up their sandcastle game?
I can tell you the biggest thing that people work against all the time is vacuum. They use buckets, and I call them dream crushers when I see little kids playing with buckets, because you tip the bucket upside down and the very first thing that happens when you go to try to take the sand out is that a vacuum forms. And so the sand mostly gets stuck in there, you know, unless it's just the perfect consistency and you get it just right. So I started using tubes or forms. PVC tubes work really well. 5-gallon buckets with the bottoms cut off them. Any sand sculpting pail with the bottom cut off it. And you just literally put the sand pail upside down on the beach and you fill it with wet sand. You tap the side and you lift it up and it's perfect. There's no vacuum. And then at least you've got something you can start carving with.
So that's, you know, the bottom. The whole bottom of the bucket is taken out. It's like not just a hole in the bucket. The bottom of the bucket is missing.
Yeah. So now it's just a tube. So now all you have is the sides, and that's all you need to support. There's other ways you can work with sand sculpting, too, that doesn't even involve buckets. Like, you can just pile up sand. But if you're just going to pile up sand, which is known as soft packing, it has to be a pyramid shape. In other words, the base has to be really big, and the very top of it really can't be that wide. So it's more like a mound of sand, and then you're just kind of moving the sand around and shaping it by hand. Not very strong, but you can create some really cool stuff with it once you learn the techniques of moving the sand around and getting it clean and looking really clear. Form carving is completely different. It's like a block of really compacted sand. And that's like the same thing when you're using a bucket. You get really hard, compacted sand. Well, what's happening when you're compacting the sand is that a tiny bridge of water is forming between each grain of sand. So next to the next grain of sand, there's another bridge of water, and another bridge of water, and another bridge of water, and connecting all those grains of sand together. Once that water dries out, you lose that bond. And if you're working with beach sand, for the most part, that's where we all learn, the beach sand is really rounded. So it's been tumbled around in the ocean. If you looked at it under a microscope, it would look more like river rock, or maybe even like really oddly shaped coral or shell, just nothing with regular sizes that match up, like almost like a jigsaw puzzle that just has no fitting parts. So there's a lot of room for air, and that creates a weakness. When we were doing a lot of our professional sculpting, we use imported sand, which is all the same size grain, all the same size shape, usually square, but they can have like different, you know, shapes, but as long as they have a lot of flat surfaces. And when you have that...
Wait, where does that sand come from? Who that is, like, imported sandcastle sand?
Yeah, it's exactly what that is. And like a lot of the major sandcastle contests use it. There are some castle contests that use native sand, but for the most part, it's all imported, especially for commercial projects. If you've ever been inside a mall and you've seen a sand sculpture, I can guarantee you it was done with imported sand. And it's literally, you go to a quarry, and the quarry is making rock. That's their number one product. But that rock gets smaller eventually. They're crushing it down. And it continues to get smaller until now you're getting into sand. And then that sand gets smaller to the point where you get what's called a byproduct of sand, which is almost like a silt. It's like a powder. And it's super fine. And that is the stuff that I like to use if I can get my hands on it. Just because it's super fine. If you looked at it in your hands, it just looks like sparkle powder. Like you can't even really pick up the sands, the grains themselves, you know, visually. They're just, you see reflections off your skin. Then you get into more coarse sand, and sometimes you have sand with clay mix in it. And, you know, it can get really dicey depending on where you're getting the sand in different parts of the country. Again, just like the snow, wherever that sand is being manufactured, it's always a little bit different. Like if we go to Maui, we get what's called Maui dune sand. It has a lot of iron in it, so it's red. And then we've carved with volcanic black sand. So it literally contains a lot of carbon, so it's black. And then like pink coral sand in the Bahamas, it's literally made of pink coral. So it's everything's different depending on what the raw material that you're starting with. In the New England area, we use granite, and it works out really well.
So this goes to something you brought up earlier, which is that sand is pretty heavy. So if you see like a sandcastle in the mall and they're importing sand for that, like just how much sand is that by weight?
Typically for like an indoor project, that you'll be starting at least 10 tons and go as high as maybe 200 tons.
I imagine 200 tons of anything. I mean, this is sand, which is like, you know, not thought of as the most expensive, luxurious material in the world. 10 tons of anything seems expensive. Just the logistics of moving 10 tons of something somewhere.
Well, you hit the nail on the head there, and it's moving it. Like the sand itself, I think when I first started buying it was under $2 a ton. And I think it's as high as like $25 a ton now, but that's still not a huge increase. The trucking is where the expense comes from. You know, you're talking about either a triaxle or an 18-wheeler that can haul at least 21 to 35 tons of sand per load. And depending on where it's coming from, I've had sand delivered as far as Washington, D.C. for projects that I've done down at the Gaylord National, where we had, I think, 50 to 60 tons of sand brought in for these big sculptures that we created inside the atrium. So it's expensive to truck it, but if you really want good sand and you know, you don't want to, it's kind of like getting a really good piece of marble. You know, you don't want to sacrifice the quality of the work just to save a couple bucks and get a cheap piece of marble where it's going to make the artwork maybe not shine as much. So that's how we look at it.
We've all sort of seen either at the beach or at the mall or online some of these like really elaborate sand sculptures that's like a dragon or whatever. I guess like what are some of the most impressive sand sculptures you've seen that have like really stood out and impressed you with what people have done in the medium?
I always get excited for anything in the automotive line when you see cars that are created in sand, because they're hard to do, first of all, just because there's such a lot of flowing, you know, lines on the car that you have to recreate. I've done a few of them, but I do them usually in forced perspective. So, like, the sculptures themselves may not be that full size, but they may be only a couple of feet deep. But I'll do, like, the front of a car, like I did a 34 Ford, and if you looked at it front on, dead on, it looked like you were looking at the car head on. If you walked around the side of it, it just looked like something flat, like an optical illusion. So that's always fun. I mean, I like that. I think people, anytime you can do a human figure in sand and you can do it life size and you can show movement, it's amazing when I see that. I just, you know, there's so much great stuff being created, and some of it's pop art, some of it's original art, some of it's contemporary. So there are different genres within the sand art world that I think is just constantly feeding new ideas into what is possible.
What are some of the major sand art genres? And also, what are some of the minor ones?
Well, I mean, like I said, I think the contemporary is big right now. It just, I think people have a lot more flexibility, impressionism, things like that. If people just get really into, you know, photo real type stuff where they're doing a lot of really realistic humans. So I think, like I said, for me, I always like look at the artwork and I say, can that be done in sand? Like when you have something that's really fragile looking, or you have something where a lot of weight is standing out. So imagine if you were going to try to create an arm extending straight out, just using sand, but no support. You know, if you took that weight and applied that to sand, you're probably looking at close to 150 pounds of sand just for the arm. So it literally defies physics. There's really no way you can get that arm to stand straight out, but there are ways to make it look that way. You know, either through bas relief, where it's more of an engraving, or sometimes you do a cut through, or there'll be something in the background that will suspend the artwork. Maybe it's flowing clothing, things like that. So it's just, you never know what people are going to do. Like, I always look at stuff and I say, wow, how is that even possible to be done in sand? And then it's like, there it is. I'm looking at it.
Well, sandcastles seem like they also, I mean, they, it seems even more fragile than a snow sculpture, right? Because it's the wind. Am I imagining this correctly?
So snow sculptures are pretty resilient, especially when you're below freezing. But with sand sculpting, you have so many elements that are working against you. You have the type of sand that you're working with. So you, if you're working with beach sand, you're already working at a detriment. You know, you're already working with a handicap that you just can't overcome, because your sand is never going to retain the water in that pond that you need to. And then on top of that, you've got the elements, whether it be rain, which rain is not the number one erosive quality that you would find with sand. It's actually the sun and the wind. So the sun dries out the sand, the wind blows away the detail. So the only way you can really combat that is when you're compacting that sand, you make it really, really dense. In other words, you get that the grains of sand so close together that it's such a tight structure, it gives it strength. And so that's going to help it withstand the wind. It's also going to help it absorb water or reflect water. So like when the rain hits that hard block of sand, instead of pushing the grains down, the grains have nowhere left to go. So the water just kind of rolls off it. And when you're done carving an area, the way you deal with the erosive qualities of the wind is you spray usually a light solution, and my mix is 2 tablespoons of Elmer's glue to 2 gallons of water. And I literally just mist the surface of whatever I've just carved that is completely clean and all done. I'm not going to go back and carve it again. And that forms an eggshell, like just a millimeter, like maybe even a half a millimeter eggshell around that area that'll protect it from the sun and the wind. So there's ways we can protect it, but like hail, doesn't like hail a lot. Not a big fan of hail, because those chunks come down and just destroy it. And then a lot of rain in a short period of time. So I could withstand 2 inches of rain in 24 hours, but if you gave me that same 2 inches of rain in 1 hour, I would have some damage for sure.
And I guess, like, you, we talked about this a little bit at the beginning, but you must just have to accept that like, this is part of the medium, and this is part of, I guess, the meaning of working in this medium, too, is that these things don't last forever, right?
That's definitely true. I mean, we want people to understand that, but at the same time, we also understand that we're working usually in commercial ventures where people always expect way more than reality, which is fine. You know, that's what we'll try to give them. You know, we'll give them a sand sculpture that kind of defies those odds by doing all the work that not everyone really knows. Well, now they do, but, you know, it's like...
Well, how do you do that? What is that? Like, what are some of the things
you can
do? Well,
like I said, doing the compaction, making sure the sand is really compacted well. So you're almost building a little bit of extra life into these sand sculptures. Like, we could certainly go into any town or community and we could create these sand sculptures lickety-split, willy-nilly, not worry about the compaction, maybe give them a light dusting of glue, walk away, and they might last a couple days or a week. But by doing a little bit of extra work, we can take the lifespan and sometimes extend them for months. even years. Like, I have sand sculptures right now that are literally some of the oldest sand sculptures in the world. They have 8 sand sculptures that are in a business throughout the Cape on Cape Cod where they're indoors. So now they're indoors. As long as people don't touch them, they're not gonna fall apart. And like the ones that we do that are around the town, they're outside. They're constantly exposed to the elements and sometimes vandals too, you know? So if it's harder to destroy, people are going to like think twice. You know, if they run into these sand sculptures and they bounce off and they end up in the emergency room because they broke their collarbone because they underestimated how strong 3 tons of sand could be to run into, you know, which happens because it's still pretty, it's a lot of sand, you know, it's 3 tons. That's as much weight as a pickup truck, right? You run into that, yeah, you're going to do some damage, but you might do some damage to yourself too. So by doing that, by spraying them, sealing them, you know, we do get, we're able to get a little bit more life out of the sculptures as long as we can, you know, kind of avoid the human element where people are overly curious or sometimes even malicious without thinking and think, you know, I'm just going to tear this down, but, you know, they don't think about the consequences of that. That no one is going to get to enjoy it after they tear it down, you know. So it's kind of the sad part about it, but it does happen.
You alluded to a sand sculpture contest that you run. I want to say, is that right?
So, yeah, my whole career, and that's kind of like really what jump started my career, is I started a big sand sculpting contest at Revere Beach. It's probably one of the biggest sand sculpting events in the country. Everybody's like all excited about it. It's in the Boston area. I ran it from 2004 to 2008, and it was like when we first started planning it, they were like, oh, yeah, this is going to be like watching grass grow. No one's going to come. These were the people in the town, you know, that I was working for. So they really didn't have a lot of faith in it. It had never been done in that area in an urban environment and on an urban beach. It's actually at the first public beach, Revere Beach. It's kind of a historic area that used to be, you know, all like an amusement park down there, and it was a big deal. So we did it, and like we got 100,000 people there the first year, which was unheard of for that type of an event. And I always was interested in it, and I got involved. I was doing some consulting work with the World Championships, which was taking place in British Columbia at Harrison Hot Springs for many years. They were running into financial problems. I tried to help them get funding for that. I worked on their website. And then the event just kind of fizzled out, unfortunately. And so I took it upon myself in 2015 to do a world championship event where sculptors were fairly compensated, really top prize money. It was a venue that was second to none. We had it at the Scottsdale Arizona Diamondbacks training facility in December at the holiday season. It was perfect. Like literally they pre-sold over 10,000 tickets for it. So it was one of those things where I think I would do it again. But having done like 2 major events that take up so much time, I think it's a big undertaking. So it may happen again in 2020. We'll see. But right now, I'm just worried about all my commercial clients right now.
And what are, like, how is the, is it judged? Is that how the winner is crowned? And if so, what are the criteria?
So the biggest issue I ran in across when I was doing events is that there really is no set guidelines in any sand sculpting contest. Even at the professional level, everybody has got their own rules, and those rules are subject to change based on whatever they feel they want to do because it's their event. And over the years, you know, those contests have kind of continued to do that. So for me, like I said, and if I'm going to create an event, I want it to be judged based on the actual criteria of the art. I want to have the best artist there that can be there. And I want the judging to be fair and unbiased. Like, I don't want it to be like, oh, you come to my event every year and you're my best buddy. I want to make sure that you walk away with some prize money because you're my best buddy. I want it to be that you earned it because you did the best sculpture. And I set criteria pretty high just based on what my expectations are, based on what I know the sand can do. You know, some people, they want to rely on stuff that they've been doing for years, and they go to, like I said, because there's no strict criteria in contests, a lot of the people that enter the contest just end up being not as serious artists, I guess, as you would if you were a serious sculptor and you were doing this as a job and this was your living and this was your trademark. So when you went around, like, it was like leaving your stamp. You know, you wouldn't want to just do a sub-period piece of artwork if you're out there selling your work as a professional. And I feel like the contest space right now is missing a lot of that professional ethics in it, where it's more just like a fun party. There are some really talented artists in the contest circuit, but I think it's just more about having fun than it is about creating serious art.
So, like, what in your mind are, like, the ideal objective criteria that would make it more about the art?
I think really you have to judge it based on the skill of the carve, the amount of sand that's carved, because each artist gets the same amount of sand, right? They get the same amount of time to carve that sand. And so it really becomes a battle of wits, a battle of creativity, and a battle of carving skills. So it's not just about, oh, create something, you know, that you think, you know, your buddy might like, but create something that is really moving to people. Like, when you see it, like, you have no other words but wow. Your brain can't even wrap around. Like, that's the big thing that you want to see.
How do you weigh, like, creativity versus, like, execution? Like, someone made something, like, totally new that no one ever thought about making in sand before, versus someone made a castle, but the execution of it is incredible. Like, it's got supports and stuff like that.
Right. That becomes really difficult, and they're almost weighed equally when you have that creativity edge and you have the technical edge. So technical carving is something that should be consistent throughout. So that's something that we always look for. So you may do really well in the technical aspect, and that could be like, okay, this guy's really good at making towers, and every tower is perfect, and all his lines are clean. But his other elements, you know, it's just a castle. So as cool as it is, you know, there's something still missing from it. Whereas if you did another guy did a castle, and he's got the dragon and the princess, and the whole thing is telling a story, to me, that guy gets it. You know what I mean? Just because he's taken all the aspects, not just the technical aspect. And some people, you know, that's the thing. That's why it's a contest. I think when you're really comparing apples to apples, which you're not, because you could have some guy create a cartoon version of whatever, right? Or something really comical that reads really well and is well carved, and it makes people laugh and it creates emotion. And then you get another guy that's creating a castle, and it creates a completely different vibe and a different gut feeling. Those are two very difficult things to judge upon each other. So it really comes down to those little things, like, is all the surface area carved? Like, you literally are splicing hairs at that point when you're trying to compare artwork like that. Like, these are both great pieces. They both should be first place, but, you know, it's a contest. So you're like, okay, this guy has probably 3 tons of sand that are just raked out at the end, and he didn't carve everything. But the other guy, he carved every square inch, and it's all exactly like it was carved the very first all the way to the very bottom. So he may get a few extra points for that, you know. And people might say, well, that's not fair. But, like, again, it's a contest. Like, you have to create criteria, and you have to stick by the criteria, whether everyone likes it or not, you know, because that's the problem, where there's no criteria that's standard across contests. So there'll never really be a unified group of contests until artists demand it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, so it's kind of one of those things where it's a great field, it has so much potential, and there's a lot of talented artists in it, but I feel like it's just kind of, you're getting the same thing year after year at all these contests. There are a handful of people that are always pushing the envelope, but the majority of people are just kind of skating by.
Are the people who are sand sculptors, are they also all snow sculptors, or are they really two different disciplines?
Yeah, there's only a handful of guys that I know that do all the disciplines that I do, and I think most of them do it more like one might be a hobby, another one might be a serious part of the business. But like for me, it was always about, you know, commercial work and corporate work. So I diversified early on, and I really focused my disciplines. Where I think a lot of the sand carvers, they may be product designers. So they are only going to contests. So they're not really even worried about like other things. Like they may have opportunities to go do an ice sculpting project in Europe or something like that. And I think you'll find like European artists are more traditionally trained in the arts. Like when they go to university, they actually spend a lot of time in really good sculpting classes and they learn all the technicals. Where in the United States, you know, even if you go to college, you're not necessarily going to end up in one of those classes. You know, so like in Europe, they get a lot more technical training. So they're able to kind of switch disciplines a little bit. And I do see like a lot more of those artists in Europe, maybe working on some ice sculpting projects. But more like a thing on the contest and exhibition stage than just like as a job, as a full-time job, you know.
What is the difference, like besides obviously the temperature, like between working with sand and snow, like what, how do you need to adjust when you're working, go from one to the other?
Yeah, it is a lot different for the tools. You know, your tool set is mostly power tools when you're working with ice and snow. Sometimes if you're working with ice, usually the biggest blocks that you're working with are 20 inches by 40 inches by 10 inches. So that's your individual block. So then it becomes like a Lego project where you have to build these shapes and fuse these blocks together. That's a whole other process. You know, you got to create heat on one block and keep the other block cold. Have you ever like reached into the ice bin and your hands are a little bit wet and you go to grab the ice cube and the ice cube sticks to your hand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's the same process that we use to fuse ice together. One side of the ice is wet and cold, and the other side, that other block, is dry and cold. And we map those two together, and that ice freezes instantly. Any water that's on that in that little seam will freeze instantly. And if the temperature is controlled and it's, you know, got a really low humidity, it's a strong bond. So you can just continue stacking that way. And then you lay out your design and you start taking away everything that's not there. Whereas sand sculpting, you're working with loose grains of sand, and you have to compact that into forms. Same thing with snow. You still have to compact the snow into existing forms. So I think sand and snow are more similar, and ice is kind of all on its own. Ice is more like literally like carving granite, like rock. You've got to use chisels, chainsaws, hammers to shape the ice, big picks, things like that. And then torches to smooth out surfaces, you know, big, powerful 100,000 BTU, just giant flamethrowers, really, is what they are.
Is there any crossover between the sand sculpting and the snow sculpting and your previous career as a mechanic? Is there anything from that previous life that you draw on when doing this? Did the working with your hands stuff, maybe?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that I draw from my time working as an auto mechanic, and one thing was the problem solving ability, where I think that at the end of the day, when you're working on a creative project, you have to solve a problem, like whatever the problem is. And in the automotive industry, it was no different. If the car wouldn't start, you had to figure out what the problem was. So for me, it's just a different sort of problem. You know, the client wants attention. How do I get attention? You know, what's the design that's going to speak to that need? So there's that aspect of it that I kind of gear up to. There's also the more business aspect side of it, whereas, you know, I understand customer satisfaction with my clients, whereas they're expecting a certain level of service, even if they really don't understand or they're hiring me for the first time. Like, they might not understand the process, but they want to be confident that I'm able to deliver in my process, you know what I mean, and be able to communicate with them. So that helped me. So I think there's a little bit of both things, you know, with the automotive thing where it was always kind of a challenge and problem solving, but then that 20-year career, like, fixing cars, like, I didn't just fix cars. I dealt with a lot of clients one-on-one. I dealt with a lot of corporate clients where, like, they had, you know, fleet rentals, and I had to talk to them and kind of understand what their needs were before we could go in and create a plan. So I think for me is I just drew on the skills that I had when I started my business and used what I had in my arsenal and applied that literally directly to my business today.
Well, Sean, it's an incredible story, really. Like, it's a rare thing, I think, to find a new career sort of midway through life, much as one as interesting and unique as this one. So good job. Very cool. One more time, what is the website? How can people find your work?
So I'm at fitzysnowman.com. That's F-I-T-Z-Y, snowman, S-N-O-W-M-A-N.com. That also adds up on Instagram. They can find me on Instagram for that. And I post a lot of time-lapse videos of the sculptures that we're currently working on. It's a lot of past work, a lot of just kind of pet projects of mine there. So, yeah, people can check that out for sure.
And again, I will link to that in the info for the podcast. Sean, thanks again.
Jeff, thanks again for having me, man. It was great. That was a HeadGum Podcast.